This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents M-Train for Sam. This is Patti Smith. It's not so easy writing about nothing. That's what a cowpoke was saying as I entered the frame of a dream. Vaguely handsome, intensely laconic, he was balancing on a folding chair leaning backwards, his Stetson brushing the edge of the dun-colored exterior of a lone cafe. I say lone, as there appeared to be nothing else around, except an antiquated gas pump and a rusting trough, ornamented with a necklace of horsefly slung above the last dregs of its stagnant water. There was no one around either, but he didn't seem to mind. He just pulled the brim of his hat over his eyes and kept on talking. It was the same kind of silver belly open road model that Lyndon Johnson used to wear. "But we keep on going," he continued, "fostering all kinds of crazy hopes to redeem the lost, some sliver of personal revelation. It's an addiction, like playing the slots or a game of golf." "It's a lot easier to talk about nothing," I said. He didn't outright ignore my presence, but he did fail to respond. "Well, anyway, that's my 2 cents. You're just about to pack it in, toss the clubs in a river. When you hit your stride, the ball rolls straight in the cup, and the coins fill your inverted cap." The sun caught the edge of his belt buckle, projecting a flash that shimmered across the desert plain. A shrill whistle sounded, and as I stepped to the right, I caught sight of a shadow spilling a whole other set of sophisms from an entirely different angle. "I've been here before, haven't I?" He just sat there, staring out at the plain. "Son of a bitch," I thought. "He's ignoring me." "Hey," I said, "I'm not the dead, not a shade passing. I'm flesh and blood here." He pulled a notebook out of his pocket and started writing. "You gotta at least look at me," I said. "After all, it is my dream." I drew closer, close enough to see what he was writing. He had his notebook open to a blank page, and 3 words suddenly materialized. "Nope, it's mine." "Well, I'll be damned," I murmured. I shaded my eyes and stood there looking out toward what he was seeing. Dust clouds, flat bed, tumbleweed, white sky, a whole lot of nothing. "The writer is a conductor," he drawled. I wandered off, leaving him to expound on the twisting track of the mind's convolutions. Words that lingered then fell away as I boarded a train of my own that dropped me off fully clothed in my rumpled bed. Opening my eyes, I rose, staggered into the bathroom, and splashed cold water on my face in one swift motion. I slid on my boots, fed the cats, grabbed my watch cap and old black coat, and headed out toward the road many times taken, across the wide avenue to Bedford Street and a small Greenwich Village cafe. Cafe Eno. 4 ceiling fans spinning overhead. The Cafe Eno is empty save for the Mexican cook and a kid named Zach, who sets me up with my usual order of brown toast, a small dish of olive oil, and black coffee. I huddle in my corner, still wearing my coat and watch cap. It's 9 a.m. I'm the first one here. Bedford Street as the city awakens. My table, flanked by the coffee machine and the front window, affords me a sense of privacy, where I withdraw into my own atmosphere. The end of November. The small cafe feels chilly. So why are the fans turning? Maybe if I stare at them long enough, my mind will turn as well. It's not so easy writing about nothing. I can hear the sound of the cowpoke's slow and authoritative drawl. I scribble his phrase on my napkin. How can a fella get your goat in a dream and then have the grit to linger? I feel a need to contradict him, not just a quick retort, but with action. I looked down at my hands. I'm sure I could write endlessly about nothing, if only I had nothing to say. After a time, Zach places a fresh cup before me. This is the last time I'll be serving you, he says solemnly. He makes the best coffee around, so I am sad to hear. Why, are you going somewhere? I'm going to open a beach cafe on the boardwalk in Rockaway Beach. A beach cafe? What do you know? A beach cafe. I stretch my legs and watch as Zach performs his morning tasks. He could not have known that I once harbored a dream of having a cafe of my own. I suppose it began with reading of the cafe life of the Beats, Surrealists, and French Symbolist poets. There were no cafes where I grew up, but they existed within my books and flourished in my daydreams. In 1965, I had come to New York City from South Jersey just to roam around, and nothing seemed more romantic than to just sit and write poetry in a Greenwich Village cafe. I finally got the courage to enter Cafe Dante on McDougal Street. Unable to afford a meal, I just drank coffee, but no one seemed to mind. The walls were covered with printed murals of the city of Florence and scenes from the Divine Comedy. The same scenes remain to this day, discolored by decades of cigarette smoke. In 1973, I moved into an airy, whitewashed room with a small kitchen on that same street, just two short blocks from Cafe Dante. I could crawl out the front window and sit on the fire escape at night and clock the action that flowed through the Kettle of Fish, one of Jack Kerouac's frequented bars. There was a small stall around the corner on Bleecker Street where a young Moroccan sold fresh rolls, anchovies packed in salt, and bunches of fresh mint. I would rise early and buy supplies. I'd boil water and pour it into a teapot stuffed with mint and spend the afternoons drinking tea, smoking bits of hashish, and rereading the tales of Mohammed Marabit and Isabel Eberhardt. Caffeino didn't exist back then. I would sit by a low window in Cafe Dante that looked out into the corner of a small alley, reading Marabit's The Beach Cafe. A young fish seller named Driss meets a reclusive, uncongenial codger who is a so-called cafe with only one table and one chair on a rocky stretch of shore near Tangier. The slow-moving atmosphere surrounding the cafe so captivated me that I desired nothing more than to dwell within it. Like Driss, I dreamed of opening a place of my own. I thought about it so much I could almost enter it, the Café Nerval, a small haven where poets and travelers might find the simplicity of asylum. I imagine threadbare Persian rugs on wide planked floors, two long wood tables with benches, a few smaller tables, and an oven for baking bread. Every morning, I would wipe down the tables with aromatic tea like they do in Chinatown. No music, no menus, just silence, black coffee, olive oil, fresh mint, brown bread. Photographs adorning the walls. A melancholic portrait of the cafe's namesake, and a smaller image of the forlorn poet Paul Verlaine in his overcoat, slumped before a glass of absinthe. In 1978, I came into a little money and was able to pay a security deposit toward the lease of a one-story building on East 10th Street. It had once been a beauty parlor but stood empty, save for three white ceiling fans and a few folding chairs. My brother Todd supervised repairs, and we whitewashed the walls and waxed the wood floors. Two wide skylights flooded the space with light. I spent several days sitting beneath them at a card table, drinking deli coffee, and plotting my next move. I would need funds for a new toilet and a coffee machine and yards of white muslin to drape the windows. Practical things that usually receded into the music of my imagination. In the end, I was obliged to abandon my cafe. 2 years before, I had met the musician Fred Sonic Smith in Detroit. It was an unexpected encounter that slowly altered the course of my life. My yearning for him permeated everything, my poems, my songs, my heart. We endured a parallel existence, shuttling back and forth between New York and Detroit, brief rendezvous that always ended in wrenching separations. Just as I was mapping out where to install a sink and a coffee machine, Fred implored me to come and live with him in Detroit. Nothing seemed more vital than to join my love, whom I was destined to marry. Saying goodbye to New York City and the aspirations it contained, I packed what was most precious and left all else behind, in the wake, forfeiting my deposit and my cafe. I didn't mind. The solitary hours I had spent drinking coffee at the card table, awash in the radiance of my cafe dream, were enough for me. Some months before our first wedding anniversary, Fred told me that if I promised to give him a child, he would first take me anywhere in the world. Without hesitation, I chose Saint-Laurent-du-Maroni, a border town in northwest French Guiana on the North Atlantic coast of South America. I had long wished to see the remains of the French penal colony, where hardcore criminals were once shipped before being transferred to Devil's Island. In the Thieves' Journal, Jean Genet had written of Saint-Laurent as hallowed ground and of the inmates incarcerated there with devotional empathy. In his journal, he wrote of a hierarchy of inviolable criminality, a manly saintliness that flowered at its crown in the terrible reaches of French Guiana. He had ascended the ladder toward them, reform school, petty thief, and three-time loser. But as he was sentenced, the prison he had held in such reverence was closed, deemed inhumane, and the last living inmates were returned to France. Genet served his time in Fresnes prison, bitterly lamenting that he would never attain the grandeur that he aspired to. Devastated, he wrote, "I am shorn of my infamy." Genet was imprisoned too late to join the brotherhood he had immortalized in his work. He was left outside the prison walls like the lame boy in Hamelin, who was denied entrance into a child's paradise because he arrived too late to enter its doors. At 70, he was reportedly in poor health and most likely would never go there himself. I envisioned bringing him its earth and stone. Though often amused by my quixotic notions, Fred did not make light of this self-imposed task. He agreed without argument. I wrote William Burroughs, whom I had known since my early 20s. Close to Genet and possessing his own romantic sensibility, William promised to assist me in delivering the stones at the proper time. Preparing for our trip, Fred and I spent our days in the Detroit Public Library studying the history of Suriname and French Guiana. We looked forward to exploring a place neither of us had been, and we mapped the first stages of our journey. The only available route was a commercial flight to Miami, then a local airline to take us through Barbados, Grenada, and Haiti, finally disembarking in Suriname. We would have to find our way to a river town outside the capital city, and once there, hire a boat to cross the Moroni River into French Guiana. We plotted our steps late into the night. Fred bought maps, khaki clothing, traveler's checks and a compass, cut his long, lank hair, and bought a French dictionary. When he embraced an idea, he looked at things from every angle. He did not read Genet, however. He left that up to me. Fred and I flew on a Sunday to Miami and stayed for 2 nights in a roadside motel called Mr. Tony's. There was a small black-and-white television bolted near the low ceiling that worked by inserting quarters. We ate red beans and yellow rice in Little Havana and visited Crocodile World. The short stay readied us for the extreme heat we were about to face. Our trip was a lengthy process, as all passengers were obliged to deplane in Grenada and Haiti while the hold was searched for smuggled goods. We finally landed in Suriname at dawn. A handful of young soldiers armed with automatic weapons waited as we were herded into a bus that transported us to a vetted hotel. The first anniversary of a military coup that overthrew the democratic government on February 25, 1980 was looming, an anniversary only a few days before our own. We were the only Americans around, and they assured us we were under their protection. After we spent a few days bending in the heat of the capital city of Paramaribo, a guide drove us 150 kilometers to the town of Albina on the west bank of the river bordering French Guiana. The pink sky was veined in lightning. Our guide found a young boy who agreed to take us across the Moroni River by pierogi, a long dugout canoe. Packed prudently, our bags were quite manageable. We pushed off in the light rain that swiftly escalated into a torrential downpour. The boy handed me an umbrella and warned us not to trail our fingers in the water surrounding the low-slung wooden boat. I suddenly noticed the river teeming with tiny black fish. "Piranha," he laughed as I quickly withdrew my hand. In an hour or so, the boy dropped us off at the foot of a muddy embankment. He dragged his pierogi onto land and joined some workers taking cover beneath a length of black oilcloth stretched over four wooden posts. They seemed amused by our momentary confusion and pointed us in the direction of the main road. As we struggled up a slippery knoll, the calypso beat of Mighty Swallow Soca Dance, wafting from a boombox, was all but drowned by the insistent rain. Completely drenched, we tramped through the empty town, finally taking cover in what seemed to be the only existing bar. The bartender served me coffee and Fred had a beer. Two men were drinking Calvados. The afternoon slipped by as I consumed several cups of coffee while Fred engaged in a broken French-English conversation with a leathery-skinned fella who presided over the nearby turtle reserves. As the rain subsided, the owner of the local hotel appeared offering his services. Then a younger, sulkier version emerged to take our bags, and we followed them along a muddy trail down a hill to our new lodgings. We had not even booked a hotel, and yet a room awaited us. The Hotel Galibee was Spartan yet comfortable. A small bottle of watered-down cognac and two plastic cups were set on the dresser. Spent, we slept, even as the returning rain beat relentlessly upon the corrugated tin roof. There were bowls of coffee waiting for us when we awoke. The morning sun was strong. I left our clothes to dry on the patio. There was a small chameleon melting into the khaki color of Fred's shirt. I spread the contents of our pockets on a small table. A wilting map, damp receipts, dismembered fruits, Fred's ever-present guitar picks. Around noon, a cement worker drove us outside the ruins of the Saint-Laurent prison. There were a few stray chickens scratching in the dirt and an overturned bicycle, but no one seemed to be around. Our driver entered with us through a low stone archway and then just slipped away. The compound had the air of a tragically defunct boomtown, one that had mined the souls and shipped their husks to Devil's Island. Fred and I moved about in alchemical silence, mindful not to disturb the reigning spirits. In search of the right stones, I entered the solitary cells, examining the faded graffiti tattooing the walls. Hairy balls, cocks with wings, the prime organ of Janae's angels. Not here, I thought, not yet. I looked around for Fred. He had maneuvered through the high grasses and overgrown palms, finding a small graveyard. I saw him pause before a headstone that read, "Son, your mother is praying for you." He stood there for a long time, looking up at the sky. I left him alone and inspected the outbuildings, finally choosing the earthen floor of the mass cell to gather the stones. It was a dank place the size of a small airplane hangar. Heavy rusted chains were anchored into the walls, illuminated by slim shafts of light. Yet there was still some scent of life, manure, earth, and an array of scuttling beetles. I dug a few inches seeking stones that might have been pressed by the hard, calloused feet of the inmates or the soles of heavy boots worn by the guards. I carefully chose three and put them in an oversized jetan matchbox, leaving the bits of earth clinging to them intact. Fred offered his handkerchief to wipe the dirt from my hands, and then shaking it out, he made a little sack for the matchbox. He placed it in my hands, the first step toward placing them in the hands of Janae. We didn't stay long in Saint Laurent. We went seaside, but the turtle reserves were off limits as they were spawning. Fred spent a lot of time in the bar talking to the fellas. Despite the heat, Fred wore a shirt and tie. The men seemed to respect him, regarding him without irony. He had that effect on other men. I was content just sitting on a crate outside the bar, staring down an empty street I had never seen and might never see again. Prisoners once were paraded on the same stretch. I closed my eyes, imagining them dragging their chains in the intense heat, cruel entertainment for the few inhabitants of a dusty, forsaken town. As I walked from the bar to the hotel, I saw no dogs or children at play and no women. For the most part, I kept to myself. Occasionally, I caught glimpses of the maid, a barefoot girl with long dark hair scurrying about the hotel. She smiled and gestured, but spoke no English, always in motion. She tidied our room and took our clothes from the patio, then washed and pressed them. In gratitude, I gave her one of my bracelets, a gold chain with a four-leaf clover, which I spotted dangling from her wrist as we departed. There were no trains in French Guiana, no rail service at all. The fellow from the bar had found us a driver, who carried himself like an extra in the harder they come. He wore aviator sunglasses, cocked cap, and a leopard print shirt. We arranged a price, and he agreed to drive us the 268 kilometers to Cayenne. He drove a beat-up tan Peugeot and insisted our bags stay with him in the front seat, as chickens were normally transported in the trunk. We drove along Route Nationale through the continuing rains interrupted by fleeting sun, listening to reggae songs on a station riddled with static. When the signal was lost, the driver switched to a cassette by a band called Queen Cement. Every once in a while, I untied the handkerchief to look at the jetan matchbox with its silhouette of a gypsy posturing with her tambourine in a swirl of indigo-tinged smoke. But I did not open it. I pictured a small yet triumphal moment passing the stones to Janae. Fred held my hand as we wordlessly wound through dense forests and past short, sturdy Amerindians with broad shoulders balancing iguanas squarely on their heads. We traveled through tiny communes like Tonate that had just a few houses and 1 6-foot crucifix. We asked the driver to stop. He got out and examined his tires. Fred took a photograph of the sign that read, Tonate, Population 9, and I said a little prayer. We were unfettered by any particular desire or expectation. The primary mission accomplished, we had no ultimate destination, no hotel reservations, we were free. But as we approached Kourou, we sensed a shift. We were entering a military zone and hit a checkpoint. The driver's identity card was inspected, and after an interminable stretch of silence, we were ordered to get out of the car. Two officers searched the front and back seats, finding a switchblade with a broken spring in the glove box. That can't be so bad, I thought. But as they knocked on the back of the trunk, Our driver became markedly agitated. Dead chickens? Maybe drugs? They circled around the car and then asked him for the keys. He threw them in a shallow ravine and bolted, but was swiftly wrestled to the ground. I glanced sidelong at Fred. He'd had trouble with the law as a young man and had always been wary of authority. He betrayed no emotion, and I followed his lead. They opened the trunk of the car. Inside was a man who looked to be in his early 30s, curled up like a slug in a rusting conch shell. He seemed terrified as they poked him with a rifle and ordered him to get out. We were all herded to the police headquarters, put in separate rooms, and interrogated in French. I knew enough to answer their simplest questions, and Fred, installed in another room, conversed in bits of barroom French. Suddenly the commander arrived, and we were brought before him. He was barrel-chested with dark, sad eyes and a thick mustache that dominated his careworn face, browned by sun. Fred quickly took stock of things. I slipped into the role of compliant female, for in this obscure annex of the Foreign Legion, it was definitely a man's world. I watched silently as the human contraband, stripped and shackled, was led away. Fred was ordered into the commander's office. He turned and looked at me. Stay calm was the message telegraphed from his pale blue eyes. An officer brought in our bags, and another wearing white gloves went through everything. I sat there holding the handkerchief sack. I was relieved I was not asked to surrender it, for as an object, it had already manifested a sacredness second only to my wedding ring. I sensed no danger but counseled myself to hold my tongue. An interrogator brought me a black coffee on an oval tray with an inlay of a blue butterfly and entered the commander's office. I could see Fred's profile. After a time they all came out. They seemed in amiable spirits. The commander gave Fred a manly embrace, and we were placed in a private car. Neither of us said a word as we pulled into the capital city of Cayenne, situated on the banks of the estuary of the Cayenne River. Fred had the address of a hotel given to him by the commander. We were dropped off at the foot of a hill, the end of the line. "It's somewhere up there," he motioned, and we carried our bags up the stone steps that led to the path to our next dwelling place. "What did you two talk about?" I asked. "I really can't say for sure. He only spoke French." "How did you communicate?" "Cognac." Fred seemed deep in thought. "I know that you are concerned about the fate of the driver," he said, "but it's out of our hands. He placed us in real jeopardy, and in the end my concern was for you." "Oh, I wasn't afraid." "Yes," he said. "That's why I was concerned." The hotel was to our liking. We drank French brandy from a paper sack and slept wrapped in layers of mosquito netting. There was no glass in the windows, neither in our hotel nor in the houses below. No air conditioners, just the wind and sporadic rain providing relief from the heat and dust. We listened to the Coltrane-like cries of simultaneous saxophones wafting from the cement tenements. In the morning, we explored Cayenne. The town square was more of a trapezoid, tiled black and white and framed with high palms. It was carnival time, unbeknownst to us, and the city was all but deserted. The city hall, a 19th-century whitewashed French colonial, was closed for the holiday. We were drawn to a seemingly abandoned church. When we opened the gate, rust came off in our hands. We dropped coins into an old chock-full of nuts can with the slogan, "The Heavenly Coffee," placed at the entrance for donations. Dust mites dispersed in beams of light, then formed a halo above an angel of glowing alabaster. Icons of saints were trapped behind fallen debris, rendered unrecognizable under layers of dark lacquer. All things seemed to flow in slow motion. Although strangers, we moved about unnoticed. Men haggled over a price for a live iguana with a long slapping tail. Overcrowded furries departed for Devil's Island. Calypso music poured from a mammoth disco in the shape of an armadillo. There were a few small souvenir stands with identical fare. Thin red blankets made in China and metallic blue raincoats. But mostly there were lighters, all kinds of lighters, with images of parrots, spaceships, and men of the Foreign Legion. There was nothing much to keep one there, and we thought of applying for a visa to Brazil, having our pictures taken by a mysterious Chinaman called Dr. Lam. His studio was filled with large format cameras, broken tripods, and rows of herbal remedies in large glass vials. We picked up our visa pictures, yet we stayed in Cayenne until our anniversary, as if bewitched. On the last Sunday of our journey, women in bright dresses and men in top hats were celebrating the end of Carnival. Following their makeshift parade on foot, we ended up at Remire Montjoly, a commune southeast of the city. The revelers dispersed. Remire was fairly uninhabited, and Fred and I stood mesmerized by the emptiness of the long, sweeping beaches. It was a perfect day for our anniversary, and I couldn't help thinking it was the perfect spot for a beach cafe. Fred went on before me, whistling to a black dog somewhat up ahead. There was no sign of his master. Fred threw a stick into the water and the dog fetched it. I knelt down in the sand and sketched out plans for an imaginary cafe with my finger. An unwinding spool of obscure angles, a glass of tea, an open journal, and a round metal table balanced with an empty matchbook. Cafés. Le Rouquet in Paris. Café Josephinium in Vienna. Bluebird Coffee Shop in Amsterdam. Ice Café in Sydney. Café Aki in Tucson. Wow Café at Point Loma. Café Trieste in North Beach. Café del Professore in Naples. Café Uraxen in Uppsala. Lula Café in Logan Square. Lion Café in Shibuya. And Café Zoo in the Berlin train station. The café I'll never realize. The cafés I'll never know. As if reading my mind, Zach wordlessly brings me a fresh cup. When will your cafe open? I ask him. When the weather changes, hopefully early spring. A couple of buddies and me. We have to get some things together and we need a little more capital to buy some equipment. I ask him how much, offer to invest. Are you sure? He asks, somewhat surprised, for in truth we don't know each other very well, complicit solely through our daily coffee ritual. Yeah, I'm sure. I once thought about having a cafe of my own. You'll have free coffee for the rest of your life. God willing, I say. I sit before Zach's peerless coffee. Overhead the fans spin, feigning the four directions of a traversing weather vane. High winds, cold rain, or the threat of rain. A looming continuum of calamitous skies that subtly permeate my entire being. Without noticing, I slip into a light yet lingering malaise. Not a depression, more like a fascination for melancholia, which I turn in my hand as if it were a small planet, streaked in shadow, impossibly blue. Changing channels. I climb the stairs to my room with its lone skylight, a work table, a bed, my brother's navy flag bundled and tied by his own hand, and a small armchair draped in threadbare linen set back in the corner by the window. I shed my coat. Time to get on with it. I have a fine desk, but I prefer to work from my bed, like a convalescent in a Robert Louis Stevenson poem. an optimistic zombie propped up by pillows, producing pages of somnambulistic fruit, not quite ripe or overripe. Occasionally I write directly into my small laptop, sheepishly glancing over to the shelf where my typewriter with its antiquated ribbon sits next to an obsolete Brother word processor. A nagging allegiance prevents me from scrapping either of them. Then there are the scores of notebooks, their contents calling, confession, revelation, endless variations of the same paragraph, and piles of napkins scrawled with incomprehensible rants. Dried out ink bottles, encrusted nibs, cartridges for pens long gone, mechanical pencils emptied of lead, writer's debris. I skip Thanksgiving, dragging my malaise through December, with a prolonged period of enforced solitude, though sadly without crystalline effect. In the mornings I feed the cats, mutely gather my things, and then make my way across 6th Avenue to Cafe Eno, sitting at my usual table in the corner drinking coffee, pretending to write, or writing in earnest, with more or less the same questionable results. I avoid social commitments and aggressively arrange to spend the holidays alone. On Christmas Eve, I present the cats with catnip-enhanced mice toys and exit aimlessly into the vacant night, finally landing near the Chelsea Hotel at a movie theater offering a late showing of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I buy my ticket and a large black coffee and a bag of organic popcorn at the corner deli, and then settle in my seat in the back of the theater. Just me and a score of slackers, comfortably isolated from the world, attaining our own brand of holiday well-being. No gifts, no Christ child, no tinsel or mistletoe, only a sense of complete freedom. I like the looks of the movie. I had already seen the Swedish version without subtitles, but hadn't read the books, so now I would be able to piece together the plot and lose myself in the bleak Swedish landscape. It was after midnight when I walked home. It was a relatively mild night, and I felt an overriding sense of calm that slowly bled into a desire to be home in my own bed. There were few signs of Christmas on my empty street, just some stray tinsel embedded in the wet leaves. I said goodnight to the cat stretched out on the couch, and as I headed upstairs to my room, Cairo, an Abyssinian runt with a coat the color of the pyramids, followed at my heels. There I unlocked a glass cabinet and carefully unwrapped a Flemish creche consisting of Mary and Joseph, two oxen, and a babe in his cradle, and arranged them on the top of my bookcase. Carved from bone, they had developed a golden patina through 2 centuries of age. How sad, I thought, admiring the oxen, that they are only displayed at Christmastide. I wished the babe a happy birthday and removed the books and papers from my bed, brushed my teeth, turned down the coverlet, and let Cairo sleep on my stomach. New Year's Eve was pretty much the same story with no particular resolution. As thousands of drunken revelers dispersed in Times Square, my little Abyssinian circled the floor with me as I paced, wrestling with the poem I was aiming to finish to usher in the new year, in homage to the great Chilean writer Roberto Bolaño. In reading his Amulet, I noticed a passing reference to the hecatomb, an ancient ritualistic slaughter of 100 oxen. I decided to write a hecatomb for him, 100-line poem. It was to be a way to thank him for spending the last stretch of his brief life racing to finish his masterpiece, 2666. If only he could have been given special dispensation, been allowed to live. For 2666 seemed set up to go on forever, as long as he wished to write. Such a sad portion of injustice served to beautiful Bolaño, to die at the height of his powers at 50 years old. The loss of him and his unwritten, denying us at least one secret of the world. As the last hours of the year ticked away, I wrote and rewrote, then recited the lines aloud. But as the ball dropped in Times Square, I realized I had written 101 lines by mistake and couldn't face figuring which one to sacrifice. It also occurred to me that I was inadvertently invoking the slaughter of the kin of the glowing bone oxen watching over the Christ child in the creche on my bookcase. Did it matter the ritual was in word only? Did it matter my oxen were carved in bone? After a few minutes of looping rumination, I temporarily laid aside my hecatomb and switched over to a movie. While watching The Gospel According to St. Matthew, I noticed that Pasolini's young Mary resembled the equally young Kristen Stewart. I placed it on pause and made a cup of Nescafe, slipped on a hoodie, and went outside and sat on my stoop. It was a cold, clear night. A few drunken kids, probably from New Jersey, called out to me. "What the fuck time is it?" "Time to puke," I answered. "Don't say that around her. She's been doing it all night." She was a barefoot redhead wearing a sequin mini dress. "Where's her coat? Should I get her a sweater?" "She's all right." "Well, Happy New Year." "Did it happen yet?" "Yeah, about 48 minutes ago." They hastily disappeared around the corner, leaving a deflating silver balloon hovering above the sidewalk. I walked over to rescue it just as it limply touched ground. "That about sums it up," I said aloud. Snow. Just enough snow to scrape off my boots. Donning my black coat and watch cap, I trudge across 6th Avenue like a faithful postman, delivering myself daily before the orange awning of Cafe Eno. As I labor yet again on variations of the hecatomb poem for Bolaño, my morning sojourn lengthens well into the afternoon. I order Tuscan bean soup, brown bread with olive oil, and more black coffee. I count the lines of the envisioned 100-line poem, now 3 lines shy. 97 clues, but nothing solved. Another cold case poem. I should get out of here, I am thinking. Out of the city. But where would I go that I would not drag my seemingly incurable lethargy along with me? Like the worn canvas sack of an angst-driven teenage hockey player. And what would become of my mornings in my little corner and my late nights scanning the TV channels with an obstinate channel changer that needed to be tapped several times into awareness? "I changed your batteries," I say pleadingly. "So change the damn channel." "Aren't you supposed to be working?" "I'm watching my crime shows," I murmur unapologetically. "Not a trifling thing." "Yesterday's poets are today's detectives. They spend a life sniffing out the 100th line, wrapping up a case, and limping exhausted into the sunset. They entertain and sustain me. Lyndon and Holder, Gorin and Eames, Horatio Kane. I walk with them, adopt their ways, suffer their failures, and consider their movements long after an episode ends, whether in real time or rerun. The haughtiness of a small handheld device. Perhaps I should be concerned as to why I have conversations with inanimate objects, but as it has been part of my waking life since I was a child, I have no problem with that. What really bothers me is why I have spring fever in January. Why the coils of my brain seem dusted with a vortex of pollens. Sighing, I meander around my room, scanning for cherished things, to make certain they haven't been drawn into that half-dimensional place where things just disappear. Things beyond socks or glasses. Kevin Shields' Ebo, a snapshot of a sleepy-faced Fred, a Burmese offering bowl, Margot Fontaine's ballet slippers, a misshapen clay giraffe formed by my daughter's hands. I pause before my father's chair. My father sat at his desk in this chair for decades, writing checks, filling out tax forms, and working fervently on his own system for handicapping horses. Bundles of the Morning Telegraph were stacked against the wall. A journal, wrapped in jeweler's cloth, noting wins and losses from imaginary bets, kept in the left-hand drawer. No one dared touch it. He never spoke about his system, but he labored over it religiously. He was neither a betting man nor had the resources to bet. He was a factory man with a mathematical curiosity, handicapping heaven, searching for patterns, and a portal of probability opening up onto the meaning of life. I admired my father from a distance. He seemed dreamily estranged from our domestic life. He was kind and open-minded, having an inner elegance that set him apart from our neighbors. Yet he never placed himself above them. He was a decent man who did his job. A runner when young, a superb athlete and acrobat. In World War II, he was stationed in the jungles of New Guinea and the Philippines. Though he opposed violence, he was a patriotic soldier. But the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki broke his heart, and he mourned the cruelty and weakness of our material society. My father worked the night shift. He slept in the day and left while we were at school and returned late at night when we were sleeping. On the weekends, we were obliged to give him some privacy as he had little time for himself. He would sit in his favorite chair watching baseball with the family Bible on his lap. He often read passages aloud, attempting to provoke discussion. "Question everything," he would tell us. Through the seasons, he dressed in a black sweatshirt, worn dark pants rolled up to his calves, and moccasins. He was never without moccasins, as my sister, my brother, and I would save our coins throughout the year to buy him a new pair every Christmas. In his last years, he fed the birds so consistently, in all manner of weather, that they came to him when he called, alighting upon his shoulders. When he died, I inherited his desk and chair. Inside the desk was a cigar box containing canceled checks, nail clippers, a broken Timex watch, and a yellowed newspaper cutting of my beaming self in 1959, being awarded third prize in a national safety poster contest. I still keep the box in the top right-hand drawer, his sturdy wooden chair that my mother irreverently decorated with decals of burnished roses, is against the wall facing my bed. A cigarette burn scarring the seat gives the chair a feel of life. I run my finger over the burn, conjuring his soft pack of Camel Streets, the same brand John Wayne smoked, with the golden dromedary and palm tree silhouette on the pack, evoking exotic places in the French Foreign Legion. "You should sit on me," his chair urges. But I can't bring myself to do it. We were never allowed to sit at my father's desk, so I don't use his chair. Just keep it near. I did once sit in the chair of Roberto Bolaño when visiting his family's home in the seacoast town of Balanes in northeast Spain. I immediately regretted it. I had taken 4 pictures of it, a simple chair that he superstitiously carried with him from one dwelling place to another. It was his writing chair. Did I think that sitting in it would make me a better writer? With a shiver of self-admonishment, I wiped dust from the glass protecting my Polaroid of that same chair. I go downstairs, then carry 2 full boxes back to my room and dump the contents onto my bed. Time to face up to the last mail of the year. First, I sift through brochures for such things like time-sharing condos in Jupiter Beach, unique and lucrative methods of senior citizen investing, and full-color illustrated packets on how to cash in my frequent flyer miles for exciting gifts, all left unopened for the recycle bin, yet producing a pang of guilt considering the amount of trees necessary to churn out this mound of unsolicited crap. On the other hand, there are some good catalogs offering 19th century German manuscripts, memorabilia of the Beat Generation, and rolls of vintage Belgium linen to stack by the toilet for future diversion. I saunter past my coffee maker that sits like a huddled monk on a small metal cabinet storing my porcelain cups, patting its head, avoiding eye contact with the typewriter and channel changer. I reflect on how some inanimate objects are so much nicer than others. Clouds move past the sun, and a milky light pervades the skylight and spreads into my room. I have a vague sense of being summoned. Something is calling to me, so I stay very still, like Detective Sarah Linden in the opening credits of The Killing on the edge of a marsh at twilight. I slowly advance toward my desk and lift the top. I don't open it very often, as some precious things hold memories too painful to revisit. Thankfully, I need not look inside, as my hand knows the size, texture, and location of each object it contains. Reaching beneath my one childhood dress, I remove a small metal box with tiny perforated holes in the cover. I take a deep breath before I open it, as I harbor the irrational fear that the sacred contents may dissipate when confronted with a sudden onrush of air. But no, everything is intact. 4 small hooks, 3 feathered fishing lures, and another composed of soft purple transparent rubber, like a juicy fruit or a Swedish fish, shaped like a comma with a spiraled tail. "Hello, Curly," I whisper, and am instantly gladdened. I lightly tap him with my fingertip. I feel the warmth of recognition, memories of time spent fishing with Fred in a rowboat on Lake Ann in northern Michigan. Fred taught me to cast and gave me a portable Shakespeare rod whose parts fit like arrows in a carrying case shaped like a quiver. Fred was a graceful and patient caster with an arsenal of lures, bait, and weights. I had my archer rod and the same little box holding Curly, my secret ally. My little lure. How could I have forgotten our hours of sweet divination? How well he served me when cast into unfathomable waters, performing his persuasive tango with slippery bass that I later scaled and pan-fried for Fred. "The king is dead. No fishing today." Gently placing Curly back in my desk, I tackle my mail with new resolve. Bills, petitions, invitations for gala events past, imminent jury duty. Then I swiftly set aside one item of particular interest, a plain brown envelope stamped and sealed with wax with the raised letter CDC. I hurry to a locked cabinet, choosing a slim bone-handled letter opener, the only proper way to open a precious piece of correspondence from the Continental Drift Club. The envelope contains a small red card with the number 23 stenciled in black and a handwritten invitation to deliver a talk of my choosing at the semi-annual convention to take place in mid-January in Berlin. I experience a wealth of excitement, but I have no time to lose, as the letter is dated some weeks ago. I hastily write a response in the affirmative, then rummage through my desk for a sheet of stamps, grab my cap and coat, and drop the letter into the mailbox. Then I cross over 6th Avenue to Eno. It is late afternoon and the cafe is empty. At my table, I attempt to write a list of items to take on my journey, but am immersed in a particular reverie taking me back through a handful of years through the cities of Bremen, Reykjavik, Jena, and soon Berlin, to meet again with the brethren of the Continental Drift Club. Formed in the early 1980s by a Danish meteorologist, the CDC is an obscure society serving as an independent branch of the earth science community. 27 members, scattered across the hemispheres, have pledged their dedication to the perpetuation of remembrance, specifically in regard to Alfred Wegener, who pioneered the theory of continental drift. The bylaws require discretion, attendance at the biannual conferences, a certain amount of applicable fieldwork, and a reasonable passion for the club's reading list. All are expected to keep abreast of the activities of the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research in the city of Bremerhaven in Lower Saxony. I was granted membership into the CDC quite by accident. On the whole, members are primarily mathematicians, geologists, and theologians, and are identified not by name, but a given number. I had written several letters to the Alfred Wegener Institute searching for a living heir in hopes of obtaining permission to photograph the great explorer's boots. One of my letters was forwarded to the secretary of the Continental Drift Club, and after a flurry of correspondence, I was invited to attend their